Welcome to another episode of the Apex Perspective Podcast. Today I have with me Mehul Desai, who is a serial entrepreneur and the current founder at Tintra. Now, Mehul, can we get started with your background in terms of when you first started becoming an entrepreneur and, of course, what led you to Tintra?
Sure. So, first off, thanks, Aryan, for the opportunity to speak to you and, of course, to reach out to your larger audience. So I appreciate the opportunity to do that. Sure. My background is in telecommunications, so I trained as a telecommunication engineer. And in the early 90s, I had an opportunity to start working in what we would today call an incubator. That term did not exist at that time in such a structured way. But essentially what we did is we looked at friction, we looked at challenges. As an entrepreneur, and I'm sure all your entrepreneurs on your show have the same philosophy, while most people think of it as a problem, as an entrepreneur, we look at that as an opportunity, as a challenge. And so we would look at friction, and then we would systematically start building the solution to that friction. And in my case, the discipline in that incubator in the early 90s was to immediately identify the intellectual property position, starting with a patent position, preferably leading into the product manifestation and eventually, figuring out what kind of people would be required to put that solution out there. And so that's how I started working. And I had an opportunity to work on lots of different things. And the reason why we started with a patent position, and I'll come back to this as part of the larger conversation, but sure. The idea was straightforward. We wanted to be very clear about what exactly it is that we were solving, what was our secret sauce, and then how that would fit into the larger value chain, especially when you're dealing with complex problems, complex friction. The solutions are complex as well. And so we wanted to make sure that we understand exactly how it works with the value chain. And downstream, if that turns into a patent, that's great. But regardless, this discipline, this exercise serves us extremely well. So in my case, I've been filing a lot of patents over the last almost 35 years now. I have close to about 150 issued patents in the U.S., probably a couple hundred on file. And the main reason for that is this discipline. So in my case, that's how I started out. Got to work on lots of interesting things in the early days. One of the ideas which came out of that incubator was digitizing leather wallets. Now, this was early 90s, maybe there are some folks in your audience who can relate to it. Maybe a lot of them cannot. But the personal digital assistant had worked. The digital diaries were out there. There were no cell phones in the early 90s, mobile phones the way you and I use them today. So in our case, we said that, look, it doesn't make sense for people to carry a leather jacket and stuff it with plastic cards and end up with a bunch of paper receipts. And so we filed a very broad patent in the U.S. The year, as a matter of fact, was 94. It was issued in 96, where we said, look, eventually all of this will get digital. And everything needs to be digitized. The leather wallet needs to be digitized, the transactions, the receipts, the value-added services which go with it, obviously, again, things that we all can now relate to very well today, almost 30 years later. And so we filed that broad patent. I started to, build a few pieces of hardware. Eventually, around 98, everyone started talking about cell phones, saying that soon there will be a lot of cell phones around the world. And at that point, we decided to set up a company. And, essentially what we identified as the big gap, the secret sauce, was a secure transaction infrastructure solution, which essentially would connect three very disparate industries. If you think about it, and this applies even today, there are service providers, which is where all transactions originate, whether it's a retail store, it's an insurance company, it's a passport issuer, it's a visa processor, it doesn't matter what that service is. Two, there is connectivity, so devices, networks, what have you. And then finally, there is a payment involved in most instances. And so in our case, what we ended up identifying to be the real gap was that secure transaction infrastructure, which would connect all of these three disparate industries. So about 20 years later, after building almost five generations of technology, deploying it across every major market, You know, I got to work, you know, on the retail side, on the finance side, on the healthcare side, government side. We had an opportunity to sell that company. And so for me, those 20 years were very formative. The patent was filed in 94. We eventually sold that company to MasterCard, the credit card company, in 2014. But personally, it not only built a tremendous professional foundation for me, I also ended up building a lot of friendships all around the world, got to collaborate with lots of interesting people, got to do a lot of other interesting things as well. For several years, I was at a task force at the U.S. Federal Reserve looking at monetary risk. These were the early days of mobile money. So I got to do lots of interesting things when it comes to innovation on the private side, on the public side, and practically everything in between. And so after selling that company,
I have a quick question for you is, how do you know, I believe this was in the early 90s, how do you know when there was going to be an adoption of cell phones that mobile payments were going to be an avenue that would be widely adopted? How do you know before it actually became that?
Simple answer is we did not know that. So frankly, when we started out, we thought this was going to be a five-year gig, literally.
Okay.
That in 5 years, there'll be enough cell phones out there. There'll be all kinds of value-added services. And the reality is we had to keep building it for 20 years.
Okay.
And looking back, and that's a great question, by the way, but looking back, what I identified to be missing was our own. And when I say our own, by the time we built that company, we were about 300 people all around the world, you know, every major market. So, you know, it wasn't just me, goes without saying, you know, we had a tremendous group of people that joined along the way. But looking back, while we all were, I would say, reasonably intelligent people, extremely dedicated, committed, hardworking, what was missing? Why did it still take us 20 years, right? Mm-hmm. To your question, putting it differently, why did we mistime it? You know, couldn't we have started later and essentially built it out? Looking back, the thing which was missing, in my opinion, was a better understanding of the value chain. If you go back to what I described, we were grappling with three extremely large industries. The connectivity industry has its own complexity. The service provider industry in the virtual world, real world, has its own complexity. And then the payment side of it has its own complexity. And because I ended up deploying this across lots of different markets, in some markets, the banking infrastructure was fairly mature. But right. A lot of other markets, it was not. So sometimes we ended up working with postal systems, and I'm just kind of giving you the level of complexity involved. And so looking back, one of the biggest things that we did not have, which for every entrepreneur that we now work with at Tantra, we would like to bring, is a very good understanding of the value chain as soon as you enter that space, saying that, look, I think there's an issue in the EV space. I think there is an issue in the fintech space. I think there's a challenge in the health tech space, in the ed tech space. And now as Tantra, we work across all of these domains. And that's why when we built Tantra about 5 years ago, one of the first things I decided to do is bring in domain experts who could immediately say that, Aryan, I think you've got a great idea to solve this friction in the health tech space. Okay, but you need to tweak it a little bit because otherwise the value chain is going to push you out.
For you
to enter the value chain, you need to pivot a little bit here, pivot a little bit there, or maybe something very different, saying, look, don't waste your time. The way you're going about this, it will never work. Having that understanding up front is critical.
And the first question, and the other question I have for you, apologize for interrupting, is with the first company you had, I believe it was called, I mean, which we were just discussing about, it's called CSEM Incorporated, right?
Yes, that is correct. So that company was called CSEM.
What I'm curious about, this was a global company, right? This doesn't global.
Very much. So we were based out of Chicago. You know, in the early 90s, the only place where we had the right skills to build this kind of technology was Scandinavia. So we had a small product team in Sweden, collaborated with a whole bunch of folks on the wireless PKI side out of Finland. And then the first market where we thought we would get good traction was Japan. And so from the get-go, we were very global, which
came
with
its
own challenges.
Did you find infrastructure was more suitable in other countries or other areas outside of the United States?
Absolutely, Arjun, absolutely. So in our case, what happened is, and again, this was us not understanding the value chain as well as we should have. And look, a lot of this looking back is easy to figure out, right? I mean, you know, at that time, it all made perfect sense. Yeah. Yeah. So we were basically rolling with the punches. And I think this is every entrepreneur's journey. You know, we started out of Chicago. We recognized that, you know, we don't know exactly where this will go technology-wise, you know, market uptake-wise, adoption-wise, scale-wise, because there are a lot of different factors which, you know, impact adoption versus very different factors which impact scale. Again, at that time, and I was in my 20s, I'm, you know, in my 50s now, at that time, you know, I was just taking all of this in. I was literally rolling with the punches. We all were as a group. And so when we started to build the technology in Scandinavia, we did some early pilots with a whole bunch of folks in Scandinavia, banks, airlines, device manufacturers. Mm-hmm. Our first mobile wallet was preloaded by the handset manufacturers. Then we realized that Japan, because they were a lot further along with value-added services, would be a larger market. So when we went to Japan, again, we had to tweak the platform, the technology, you know, solve for a totally different set of issues. I ended up selling our first license in Japan. And then bit by bit started to deploy it across every major market, you know, starting with Asia, eventually a little bit of the Middle East, Gulf, a little bit of Europe. And almost 10, 15 years into this process, the U.S. market, you know, kind of started to pick up. Now, the U.S. Mm-hmm. market was always driving intellectual property. It was always driving standards. But as we know very well, in the U.S., everything is around scale. Everything revolves around scale. No one's interested in something which would work for a million people. You know, in the U.S., we always solve for how do I make it work for 300 million people, right? And so in our case, that long journey eventually paid off because as we started to work with the U.S. carriers, they were trying to figure this thing out at scale. And then the service providers and the banks and everyone else. And so in our case, as we eventually figured out how to get this deployed across the U.S., in many ways, that also signaled the end for us as an independent technology provider. The whole market had changed. You know, when we started out, it was about pioneering and evangelizing these ideas. We ended up writing a book along the way, you know, because, I mean, the book we wrote was really to give to our partners and customers saying that, look, we've written a book, you know, just to explain how mobile money is eventually going to evolve and scale. And so all in all, those 20 years were extremely formative and they've served me extremely well. I mean, after selling that company, I set up a few more companies, some on my own ideas or related to my own ideas, some related to friends, you know, around the world. And it was a mixed bag. Some things worked and some things did not. Along the way, I got to do one thing at scale. There was a large financial services group, very old-fashioned, you know, doing cross-border payments, foreign exchange. I had worked with them in the early 2000s, and they reached out to me saying that, look, we would like to, you know, build a global fintech strategy. We recognize that at some point our business will go away and the fintechs will take over, and we need your help to do that. And I'd never done anything at that scale. They were in 170 markets, moving over $100 billion. So I said, this would be educational. This would be interesting. So I did that. Then they decided to go public. They asked me to help them with that. I'd never taken a company public before. So I said, this would be educational. I got to do that. And then a huge scandal hit the group and I got to preside over that for a short time as the new buyers came in and they kind of took over that company. And so all in all, in my case, looking back, I've been blessed. Literally, I've just had, you know, tremendous opportunity to learn and collaborate all around the world. And, you know, to kind of, you know, wrap up the background part, in many ways, it was these learnings and, you know, these friendships, these collaborations that I built. I personally don't like to use the word network. It makes it sound very impersonal. Okay. But in my case, these relationships and collaborations that I built all around the world, come 2020, when the pandemic hit and the whole world was forced to kind of take a pause, I started to sketch. And I said that, look, eventually we all will come out of it. And when we do, what is it that I'm going to work on next? And so in my case, Aryan, one of the things which kind of stuck with me prior to the pandemic was this whole progression of now what we call a tantra, ideas to risk mitigated innovation to impact, right? And so if you think about it, we all have ideas. Okay, everyone, it doesn't matter, global, south, north, developed, developing, everything in between. But what really matters is this process of how you take ideas and then you risk mitigate them, which in one sense is how innovation happens. Mm-hmm. And then if you can take it further along that progression, you get large scale impact.
Right.
And so in my case, in 2020, I started to sketch saying that, look, with all my learnings and observations of at that point, 30 odd years bouncing around the world, doing interesting things, if I had to institutionalize all the things that I had learned, which worked specific to taking ideas, transforming them into innovation and further delivering impact, how would I go about doing it? And as we know very well, there's always part science and there's part art. And I was under no illusion saying that it's all science. No, I wanted to make the right space for the art, but I also wanted to make sure we're extremely efficient around the science part of it. And so I started to sketch, and essentially that is what has led to Tantra now. So Tantra is a global innovation ecosystem. We are AI first, we're IP enabled, because from day one, almost 6 years ago, we started to kind of find the right balance between AI and what we call the humans in the room. But the core philosophy which drove everything we did and continues to drive us today is how do we bring intellectual property into this progression of ideas to innovation to impact? And by intellectual property, I don't mean just patents, but the product manifestation and then the people part of it. The most important part of intellectual property are the people. And so if you don't figure out how you're going to bring the people on board, build the people that you need for your idea, innovation, eventually the impact, you're leaving a huge part of the intellectual property out there. And so that's essentially what Tantra does now.
So what is the process itself with Tantra to be able to do this, connecting, of course, intellectual property with people itself to make sure it's valuable?
Great. So 5 years into this, we now essentially have three fundamental building blocks at Tantra. I like to describe it as three legs to the stool. One is engineering services, because that's how ideas get manifested. Two are a series of enterprise platforms. And by the way, we work with everyone from startups all the way to large enterprises. And now we're also getting pulled into some very interesting government initiatives, right? So this whole progression, once again, of ideas to innovation to impact is not exclusive to just startups or, you know, big companies have the same challenges, albeit they have to address it at a very different level of scale. Mm-hmm. And so at Tantra, we have engineering services. We also have a series of platforms that we've now built, which fundamentally link an ecosystem's innovation needs to their participants' lifelong learning, eventually to the execution. One of my observations, Arjun, bouncing around once again, was that the whole process of innovation, how you deal with innovation, and then how you deal with the learning related to innovation is disjointed. Mm-hmm. And it sounds odd, but you know, think of any corporation, right? It doesn't matter what size. They're a very different group of people who deal with innovation. They're a very different group of people, products, processes, which deal with lifelong learning and retention. And then most often, very different group of people who deal with the execution of it. And if you think about it, it's this disjointed nature, which fundamentally, A, makes innovation inefficient.
They're divisions.
And B, drives a lot of disparity into innovation, right? So when we kind of take a step back and you look at the whole world, we know anecdotally, all of us do. Right. You and I know this, you know, your audience knows this, that innovation still largely comes down to throwing a bunch of things at the wall and seeing what sticks. Okay.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have to ask yourself why. Why is it that way? It's not because we're lacking, you know, methodologies and processes and what have you, not even platforms in that sense. But one of the biggest gaps that we identified is there isn't a single process and platform which links innovation to lifelong learning to execution. Mm-hmm. And so coming back to Tantra, the second leg of our stool are a series of platforms which link everything. Again, doesn't matter what size of a innovation ecosystem. Hence, we apply this to startups, to corporations or enterprises, all the way up to government agencies, because this fundamental disconnect exists everywhere. And then finally, we have a group of things that we do under what we call advisory, where we have a IP practice, we have an AI practice, We have our own incubator. We have a small venture fund. We've kind of bundled a whole bunch of things under what we call advisory. So fundamentally, mm-hmm. what Tantra does is it brings all three legs to anyone who wants to go from ideas to risk mitigation,
execution,
innovation to impact.
Okay, a question for you is there a particular industry or a particular size of a company that has a more prevalent issue with the disconnect between innovation and learnings?
Frankly, in our experience, this applies everywhere. And we now work with a lot of different industries. So going back to one of the lessons I learned from the CSAN episode was a better sense of the value chain, right? And so one of the things I wanted to solve for at Tantra was precisely that, saying the next mm-hmm. time Aryan or any entrepreneur from around the world comes to us, how can I help them squeeze 20 into 10, into 5, maybe into 2 years, right? And this isn't the fail quickly philosophy, right? This is how do I transition, pivot, and make this thing work, okay? And so for me, that led to finding domain experts, saying the minute I find a deep domain practitioner, an expert mm-hmm. who has actually worked in an area, I want to bring them into the Tantra, what I refer to as the incestuous global ecosystem, so that now, let's say if you are trying to address an interesting friction around health tech, you know, I anecdotally, I've done work in the health tech space, but I'm not a health tech expert. I need to direct you immediately to a health tech expert who can say, right. Aryan, this is how it's going to work in the value chain. Yeah. Right. And so what we've now done at Tantra over the last 5+ years is we've got a lot of interesting domain experts who are all deep tech practitioners who mm-hmm. have actually learned their trade deploying things. Okay. And we have access to them. So now if I see something in the ed tech space, I can immediately connect them to them. FinTech, yeah. in my case, because I've done a lot of work in FinTech, I have a whole bunch of FinTech people as well. So going back to your question on what size of the company where we see this, frankly, it doesn't matter. As a matter of fact, smaller the company, a startup has a better chance of addressing all of this, saying that, look, how do I, you know, ensure that I start with the right process, saying, how do I build my business plan around intellectual property as mm-hmm. opposed to just a business plan around a business model, right? Not to say that the business model yeah. isn't important, okay, but you have to understand how your intellectual property is going to translate into the business model, not vice versa.
Right. So if we talk about something you're deeply involved in and intimately understood, it's with regard to CSAN specifically. How do you think if Tantra was existent then, or the process behind Tantra existed then, how quickly would you have understood this problem of the value chain and addressed it?
I would like to believe if we had Tantra at that point, what took us 20 years, we should have been able to do it in anywhere between 5, no more than 10 years, right? I mean, our goal at Tantra is to say, can I squeeze that down to 2? That's what we aspire mm-hmm. to do. And this mm-hmm. is not a hard line, right? I mean, no. Every idea.
It's based on principles. And what's true. Market.
But that's the objective, saying that, yeah. look, how can I compress it down? So simply put, you know, if Tantra existed at that point, I don't think it would have taken us more than 5 years to figure
what
out
would change
exactly
specifically,
what we should do where.
What would change specifically in the operations of CSAM if Tantra existed? What specifically would happen?
Every aspect of what I now call the 3 P's, right? The way we built our patent portfolio, which served us mm-hmm. extremely well at CSAM. The mm-hmm. way we architected our product service manifestation would potentially mm-hmm. have looked very different. The way we built our people would have looked very different. And then most importantly, how these 3 P's, how this intellectual property gets translated into a business model and finds its way into the marketplace would have fundamentally looked very different. So don't get me wrong. There's not a single day in my CSAM journey looking back that I would change. But I would have loved to kind of compress those 20 years into 10, preferably into 5, right? Because mm-hmm. a lot of good could then have come out of that. And frankly, lots of interesting ideas could have, you know, scaled even further.
Mm-hmm. If we talk about idea execution now, which is, I'm assuming, shouldn't be too different between small companies and large companies, how does the standard model look like right now? I'm sure it's something you've also experienced at CSAM, but what does the standard model look like right now? And why are those divisions causing these longer gaps of time?
So I would, again, if I had to generalize it, regardless of what market, what industry, what vertical, and it goes without saying, Some folks do this extremely well. And at the other end of the spectrum, there are folks who struggle with this constantly. And then vast majority of companies and industries and markets are somewhere in between, right? It's always like that. But if I had to generalize it again, the way I would generalize it is this disconnect between how does an enterprise think of innovation at large? How does it link it into their participants? And by participants, it's not just employees, right? It could be your partners. It could be your value chain. You know, as your industry and footprint grows, your participant, the ecosystem around that grows as well, right? Mm-hmm. So if you think about it, how does innovation drive the participants' learning? And then in turn, how do the participants' learning get translated into execution? If all of this does not literally sit on a common platform, is not driven by a common set of methodologies,
there's still gaps.
Three very distinctly different things, you are not going to see the efficiency that you need.
And there will still be gaps in the problem you're trying to solve if they're not all connected. So you said
there will always be gaps. I mean, this is not to say that, look, this is a foolproof way of going from zero to 100, right? Mm-hmm. But it's all about saying, how do I get more and more efficient with it? How do I risk mitigate my ideas? Mm-hmm. Again, ideas, let's say you could be a 20,000 people corporation around the world. Mm-hmm. Ideas still happen within different groups, right? Within different divisions, within teams. Okay, so the whole process of, we've got an idea in this pizza team. Okay, how does that idea get translated into efficient, risk mitigated innovation? And eventually, how does this deliver impact? It's not exclusive to, you know, a startup, or it's not exclusive to a government, you know, agency. It applies to everyone. Okay. And obviously, the larger the organization, the more markets, different cultures that you work with, okay, you have to solve for this in a very different way. But the fundamental setup is still the same.
Mm-hmm. But it allows you, if you aren't in multiple markets, multiple global markets specifically, how your idea is perceived, how your solution is perceived in different markets, perhaps there might be something else that could be needed or be more efficient there. So this is exactly what allows you to understand what those other issues might be in differing markets, not one that you're primarily situated in, but ones that are potentially global. Is that correct?
That is correct. And again, in my case, because I got to bounce around, I got to deploy technology across every major market prior to setting up Tantra. And frankly, even after setting up Tantra, the global aspect of the work and exposure that I've had continues. So I've had an opportunity to build teams in lots of very different markets. And the reason why I say this is every market culturally is different. One of my observations is that, you know, every place has its own what I call cultural DNA. Mm-hmm. And by that, what I mean is that every place does certain things differently, right? And so the way we culturally work, let's say in the US, is very different from, let's say, how people culturally work in Japan or China or India
and the UAE.
Or Germany or France or UAE or Africa or South America, right? And so because over the years, I've been working, deploying technology, working with partners, building teams in a lot of very different markets. At Tantra, we also have the ability to kind of bring all those observations into the methodology, right? Saying that regardless of the culture, there are still certain things that you want to try and do differently. As I said earlier, right, the idea is to put enough science so that the science part of it is efficient. And then there is always going to be the art, saying, look, there's a huge advantage of being global. I experienced this with CSAP, that if I did not have a global footprint, I would not have had the ability to say, I'm thinking of intellectual property in the US. I'm designing this using skills in Scandinavia. I'm licensing this technology for the first time in Japan. Okay. Yep. And so in many ways, having the ability to do that opened up our eyes, saying that, look, I think this is the right market. If we pivot and change it a little differently, in Japan, it could be about financial services, but in India, it could be about large government programs. In the US, it could be about healthcare. The same fundamental technology has to solve for all of this. How do I architect this in such a way that while adoption around financial services in the US may take longer, I can use my same technology to solve it for healthcare? It's this ability to kind of, you know, transcend markets, which fundamentally come down to that same process.
And the solution you may have right now may not be fit for a particular market like you faced with CSAM, but it might be particularly effective because a market might be mature enough for it, like in Japan for CSAM. I love that perspective. So how does a company who is not accustomed, or the founder of a company who's not accustomed to differing markets potentially, might be able to use Tintra to enter and expand into different markets to see if that solution is more effective there?
Well, so that's why we have an incubator. Okay, so within Tintra, we have our own incubator. And the main reason why we decided to set up the incubator is to work with, you know, typically first-time entrepreneurs, saying that, look, we have this interesting idea. We think there is a huge market for this. How do you systematically go from taking that idea to translating it into that impact? Again, for me, everything comes down to ideas, to innovation, to impact. And so everything revolves. Our platforms revolve around that. Our methodologies revolve around it. Market access, domain experts feed into that. So everything revolves around that progression.
Mm-hmm. Love it. So what I want to do now is go ahead and shift this conversation to a little bit more about you, Mehul. And the first question I have for you is, you've traveled the world, and of course you've developed teams in different parts of the world. I'm curious, what's your number one learning from traveling the world globally and actually working those in global markets?
So I'm glad you asked that. So at a very personal level, one of the things I've learned is 8 times out of 10, if you are nice to people, people will always be nice to you. Always. 8 times out of 10. There are always going to be those two, let's just say, weirdos. But for the sake of who those two weirdos are, I'm not going to second guess who the 8 are. And so my learning and philosophy even today is, regardless of where I go in the world, just be nice to everyone. I, you know, unfortunately did not pay enough attention to pick up a lot of different languages. I speak a few. But that said, I made it a practice. Every new place I go to, the first thing I learn to say is thank you in the local language. I can say thank you in over a dozen languages. Mm-hmm. And so if you ask me at a personal level, this has nothing to do with technology and IP and fintech or health tech. It's just it's just basic connection at a human-to-human level. And the reason why I say this is, if you don't have that, Aryan, you don't have anything. It doesn't matter. Okay, I may have a fantastic idea. I may have lots of patents. I may have a lot of quote-unquote success around companies. But if I cannot establish a human-to-human connection, everything falls flat. Everything pales in comparison. So if you ask me what is my single biggest learning at a personal level, it's just that.
I love it. And I also want to comment on something regarding that. Something I've had the pleasure to do with the Apex Perspective podcast is that this is not a podcast that's only based in the US. I've had the pleasure of interviewing people from the UAE, from Canada, from United Kingdom. And what's very interesting to test what you said is that it's basic courtesy. I think if you show courtesy and people always show you courtesy back, but it's also about really genuinely being a person who wants to learn about the other person, being someone who focuses on the connection itself as opposed to a transaction. I think those are universal principles as opposed to one single, you know, principle that you find potentially in the US. So I want to test what you said about being global. I think it's absolutely an amazing thing. And you learn more about humanity in general from the universal standpoint. So I love that perspective. The question I have for you next is, from your point of view, what is something you wish more people knew about regarding your life?
So thanks for asking. I have had an opportunity to have these kinds of conversations. You know, I would say more so in the past few years than when I first started working. So I don't think there are many aspects of my life, you know, which are not already out there. Yep. I love people. One of the things, probably the only thing that I genuinely treasure, is the time that I have. Everything else in my experience comes and goes. And so the one commodity that I pay most attention to, Aryan, is the time. Yep. And by that, what I mean is I'm very careful about who I want to interact with, collaborate with, spend my time with. And, you know, essentially, let's say if I have an opportunity to work on, I'll just make it up, $1 billion, you know, challenge or idea. But if the people that I will be working with don't excite me as much, I don't want to take that on. as opposed to, let's say I meet you and I have no idea where this conversation will go. But if you are an interesting person who I know I will enjoy my time, spending my time with, I'll absolutely jump in. And so the one thing about me, which, you know, all of my friends and collaborators around the world know, I put a premium on the people I interact with. And it's a two-way street. You know, it's important. Just because I like you doesn't necessarily mean that you will like me, right? So, you know, as long as we both feel that the time we're spending together is well spent, I don't really care as much about the outcome. Now, don't get me wrong. I am focused on outcomes from an efficiency standpoint. I want to get the maximum bang. I want that impact. You know, again, you know, idea just ending at efficient innovation isn't enough. I want to push it further and get large scale positive impact out of it. Okay. But what deeply kind of, you know, touches me at a personal level is the time that I'm spending. So every company I've had an opportunity to now build over the last 30, 35 years, I've absolutely enjoyed the people and the interactions and the collaborations around the world. Not necessarily all of those companies were successful in, you know, doing what they were set up to do. As a matter of fact, you know, I have had to come, you know, shut down a couple of companies over the years as well. Okay, but my interactions with the people involved were always phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. Love it. You started CSAM in your 20s and you worked on that company in your 20s. What kind of person were you at that age?
Good question. I don't think I've been asked that before. So look, some of the obvious things, very naive. Maybe I don't think I was intentional about it, but I'm sure I was arrogant. I'm sure I was obnoxious. And I don't think many people, you know, call that out, but, you know, that doesn't mean that I wasn't those things. At a certain level, maybe that ignorance served us well. And again, I don't want to give you the impression that I did all of this on my own, right? We had tremendous folks with us from the get-go. And a lot of them stayed with us all the way through to the end. And so I think when I look back, once again, not that I meant to be, but I think that's probably what I was. I was ignorant in general. I'm not trying to, again, give you or your audience the impression that I'm extremely wise now. Not a day goes by where I don't learn something new. But, you know, the values that I was brought up with, I was taught to always be humble. And I think when I started working, I did not quite understand what humble or humility really was. And if you ask me, now the last 30 years have taught me, and in many instances the hard way, what real humility is. And so I don't think I was as humble as I would have liked to be when I started working out.
Well, what I'm curious about is, I'm sure in your 20s, a lot of people around you were at stable jobs. I think it's very traditional for humans to go towards safety. What compelled you to choose a more unpredictable path?
So, look, I think probably if I had to single, you know, one factor out, it was the incubator that I started working in. That was my very first job. We called it the new products division at the time. And for me, what really clicked was kind of fixating on an endpoint. And the endpoints have evolved. So back then, I think one of the first things that I started to work on, if I recall correctly, was smart grids and electronic ballasts and how you can efficiently do lighting. And, you know, again, think of the world in the 90s. And this whole process of fixate on an endpoint and then work backwards really grabbed me. And this incubator taught me how to do that. And it gave me the skills in terms of everything from mindset to, you know, some of the more tactical things to say that, you know, this process is important. So even if you think about now Tantra, which is where I spend a lot of my time today, Tantra started the exact same way. I said that, look, I've had an opportunity to work on lots of interesting products and technologies and markets and verticals. What do I want to do next? And I said, you know what? Why can't we do innovation more efficiently? You know, why did it take us 20 years? Why can't we do it in two? And so it was that endpoint which led to Tantra and everything that Tantra has done in the last 5+ years now. And so for me, this process really grabbed me. And that has now, frankly, I've been lucky. Like I said, I've been blessed. And that process has served me extremely well. And I've seen some great outcomes come from it. I've seen some failures come out of it as well.
Love it. And one last question for you on the personal side is, do you believe that your values or your principles have changed much since your 20s, or are they very much the same?
No, I would like to believe they've not changed at all. I firmly believe that all of our values, you, me, and you know everyone out there, our values get locked in very early in life. And after that, you're just adding layers of complexity on it. But my core values have always been the same. There is this deep kind of desire to truly be empathetic. It's a word we all throw around a lot, but it's actually very, very difficult to implement. And for me, that's what life is all about. How do you go from aspiring to truly be empathetic to eventually, hopefully, genuinely being empathetic? And so that value has stayed with me. And once again, while layers of complexity keep getting added onto it, that's the deep down desire to kind of eventually get to a point where you're genuinely empathetic all the time.
Yeah. Now what I'll do is go ahead and share a quick perspective regarding fitness and health, and then we'll go ahead and move on to Mehul's plans for this year or the following year or whatever he wants to include with the podcast, and then we'll conclude from there. The perspective I really want to share today is focusing on solving the problem of making a fitness and health approach as time efficient as possible. But that really requires us to look at the basic requirements. If you look at the National Institute of Health, there's really two main ones. One, you have to get the right amount of movement, and then two, you have to have the right nutrition or calorie intake. But out of these two, what actually takes the time is actually the movement, because you have to be at a specific fixed location, like a gym or potentially like a studio. So how can you really restructure that to be as time efficient as possible? The reason my aim is to make it time efficient is because if you're stuck in the office the whole day, if you're traveling, the capacity to go to a gym is pretty much not there. Therefore, you're costing yourself progress on those particular days, which I'm assuming for an entrepreneur, for an executive, is quite common. So looking at that, you have to be very clear on what those requirements are. Again, it's the movement and then it's your nutrition intake. If the goal is specifically lose fat and lose weight, of course, you have to look at restructuring how you do your movement. Instead of it being at one fixed location, make it location independent, something you can do anytime, anywhere, as opposed to one fixed location. What I would primarily recommend is something like step count, because step count is something you can do while you listen to this podcast. It's something you can do when you're traveling. It's something you can do while you're taking a business call. It's something that adapts to your schedule as opposed to you making time for it. And that was the primary perspective that I really want to share today, is really defining the requirements and making it as time efficient as possible. And step count is exactly what I use myself, in fact, to lose over 70 pounds, of course, and actually keep it off. So my whole goal with that conversation of this particular segment is really change the thinking process behind making a physical transformation. Because I find personally that when I talk to entrepreneurs offline, when I talk to executives offline, it's a perspective of the schedule that gets in the way. But if you restructure how you look at it and you look at the requirements, I think it's a lot more doable with the right perspectives. So that was a perspective I really want to share today. What we'll do now is go ahead and move on to Mehul's plans for this year or the coming year.
So by the way, I love that perspective, and I think it's very important. Personally, I try to do the two things that you just talked about. I also try very consciously to do a third, which is find time to meditate. And I think in general, between, you're absolutely right, the right diet, the right movement, as you called it, what has served me personally extremely well is also finding that time. And in my case, I try and do it every morning before I get busy, is to just, meditate and try and get grounded. But I love that. I love the perspective. So coming to your question, at Tantra, we are now kind of hitting a very interesting stride. We're getting to do exactly what Tantra was conceived and set up to do 5 years ago, which is to work with lots of interesting people out there, different size companies. Like I said, you're getting pulled into some very interesting government ecosystems where they're fundamentally grappling with the same issues. Around the world, and again, this is nothing new, because of the disparity that exists in terms of resources, One of the things at Tantra we're trying to do is we're trying to say that even if you're resource strapped, you're not idea strapped. You're not constrained by ideas. How can you still take your ideas and turn them into innovation and deliver impact? So don't let resources, the availability or the unavailability of it, limit how you progress your own needs of ideas to innovation to impact. So coming back to where we are and what is happening next, I think in the next 1 to 2 years, we're going to get to validate a lot of these things even more, Aryan. And that's what excites me immensely.
Excellent. Well, Mehul, where can people learn more about Tantra and more about you yourself?
So for Tantra, just go to www.tntra.io. So that's again, tntra.io. As far as my personal portfolio is concerned, just go to www.dezai.co. And again, Perfect. That's dezai.co.
Well, Mehul, thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. It was really a pleasure to learn more about really the problem you're solving and how passionate you are about making sure idea to execution becomes widely accessible and really understanding your perspectives from even your background with CSAP. Thank you again. I really appreciate your time. This was Aryan Mahindra and Mehul Desai. Thank you for listening.